Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. The sun is shining and the forecast is for sunny weather the next few days, with temperatures into the mid-70s starting Monday. Aren't you glad you're not in Texas, where power outages and sub-zero temperatures have put lives of many residents at risk? Here in San Diego, we have some updates for you today on the COVID-19 vaccine. The good news is that starting March 15th, the vaccine will be available to people over age 16 with certain serious pre-existing conditions. The bad news is that shipping delays of some vaccines have caused some of the local vaccination sites to temporarily halt vaccinations or limit appointments only to those due for the second dose. But some other sites, such as Grossmont Center with the Pfizer vaccine, are continuing to book appointments, and we'll have details on today's show. Children in El Cajon may soon have a splashy new water feature to play in at Wells Park. Also in El Cajon, Amazon.com, the world's biggest online retailer, is looking to build a distribution center near Gillespie Field, potentially bringing hundreds of jobs to East County. Santee's City Council has sent a resolution to Supervisor Nathan Fletcher asking him to apologize for remarks suggesting that organizers of efforts to recall Governor Gavin Newsom have ties to racist extremist groups. Fletcher says the city of Santee has officially lost its mind. Hear more reactions to the council's actions on today's show. On Crime Beat, a pursuit in East County ended in tragedy, with a crash that killed a 21-year-old woman and injured two others, including a young child. From Public News Service's 2021 Talk, we'll have some national news stories today, including the Biden administration's efforts to provide relief for Texans suffering during those extreme winter weather conditions that have caused burst pipes and power outages. The Biden administration has announced changes to the Trump administration's Wait in Mexico policy for people seeking asylum in the U.S. While some immigrants in dire medical need and those who've been waiting the longest will be admitted immediately to the U.S. while awaiting their asylum hearings, it could be weeks or months before all of the 25,000 people waiting in border camps will be processed while authorities revamp immigration procedures. From California News Service, hear why pediatric dental visits are down during the pandemic and what you should know to protect your children's teeth. On the second half of our show today, we are delighted to have bookshelf host Raina Menasche back, and she'll be interviewing Roger Scholey, historian and former San Diego Union-Tribune reporter, on his new book, San Diego Memories, the third in a series on our region's colorful local history. And finally, we'll be re-airing one of our Best of East County favorite episodes, Master Gardener Connie Beck, with some spring planting ideas to attract butterflies and hummingbirds to your garden. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
This is Alexa Oslowski with an important health update on COVID-19 vaccines. California has announced new COVID-19 guidelines that allow anyone over the age of 16 who have certain serious underlying conditions to receive the vaccine starting March 15th. The vaccine will be available for those over 16 with any of the following serious underlying health conditions or disabilities that would put them at high risk of hospitalization or death from the novel coronavirus: cancer, chronic kidney disease, chronic pulmonary disease, Down syndrome, weakened immune system from solid organ transplant, pregnancy, sickle cell disease, some heart conditions, severe obesity, and type 2 diabetes mellitus, and developmental disabilities, if COVID would limit their ability to receive ongoing care or services or impair their treatment of COVID. All Californians over the age of 65 are already eligible to receive the vaccine, as are frontline healthcare workers and others in Tier 1 and Tier 2A. Educators, first responders, food and agricultural workers are expected to have vaccines available within 2 or 3 weeks, followed next by those age 50 and over, regardless of whether they have any underlying health conditions. The Moderna and Pfizer vaccines currently available require 2 doses to be fully effective, with immunities built up about 2 weeks after each dose. The first dose provides approximately 50% protection, while the second dose raises that to about 95% effectiveness. Just as important, these 2 vaccines were found in testing to be 100% effective at preventing deaths and serious cases of COVID. The small percentage of people who received the vaccine and still got COVID had only mild to moderate cases. Neither of these vaccines is yet approved for minors under the age of 16. However, safety tests are underway on those ages 12 and up. After that, tests are planned for those ages 6 and up in hopes that vaccination of children will be possible within months. The Biden administration this week announced that it has purchased orders for enough Pfizer and Moderna vaccines to fully vaccinate 300 million Americans with both doses by July, or nearly the entire United States population of 323 million people.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health report. Some local vaccination sites are postponing appointments for the COVID-19 vaccine due to not receiving vaccine shipments. That's in part due to shipping delays caused by severe winter storms in several states and in part due to delays in shipments of the Moderna vaccine. The vaccine superstation at Petco Park has paused all appointments through at least Saturday, a closure that may be extended through Monday depending on when more vaccine doses arrive. The North County Superstation in San Marcos and some other county-run sites are only offering appointments for second doses currently, rescheduling others for next week. However, the Grossmont Center site in La Mesa and the Chula Vista sites, both run by Sharp, are still offering first and second dose appointments with the Pfizer vaccine. The county's vaccination superstation at the Del Mar Fairgrounds is open and honoring previously scheduled appointments. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has advised that people can wait up to 42 days between doses and still achieve maximum immunity. So people who receive their first dose and have minor delays now in the second dose don't need to be concerned, according to health officials. San Diego County is faring better in combating COVID-19. The latest test, reported on February 17th, had a 4% positive testing rate, with a 2-week average of 5.2%. That's a lot lower than in recent weeks. The number of new cases reported February 17th is 810, although 36 more deaths were also reported. In the past week, 33 community outbreaks were reported. If cases continue to trend downward, along with hospitalizations, San Diego could soon drop into a less restrictive tier, which could trigger the state to allow more businesses to open and/or change restrictions on gatherings.
Children in El Cajon may soon have a water feature to play in at Wells Park, such as a splash pad or spray jets. Councilman Gary Kendrick proposed the idea, and on Tuesday, the El Cajon City Council voted unanimously to ask staff to research funding sources to make it happen. The city has many children from low-income households with only limited access to recreational facilities, so Councilman Gary Kendrick wants to provide a fun way to help kids cool off on those hot summer days. He told East County Magazine, "I grew up in Santee, and we didn't have air conditioning until I was 14. He recalls having fun as a child running through the sprinkler in the front yard during those hot summer days. But now, Councilman Kendrick says, we have a lot of children who live in apartments on the valley floor who don't have front yards. This would be our gift to the children of El Cajon. Whether a water feature will be built or how elaborate it might be will likely depend on whether funding sources can be found, such as grants or donation from a local service club. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Mitchell Murphy.
Amazon.com, the world's largest internet company, has announced plans to build a distribution center in El Cajon. The company is in the permit approval stage to build a new 140,000-square-foot distribution center near Gillespie Field on the west side of Cuyamaca Street and Weld Boulevard. If approved, the project is expected to bring 300 to 500 jobs to El Cajon, where 21.7% of the population lives below the poverty rate, according to Data USA, and the city's unemployment rate was 10.2% as of year's end, according to Y Charts. The company has begun meeting with neighbors to address any concerns as part of the approval process. Some neighbors have raised concerns over noise levels and potential impacts on property values, particularly if the facility operates around the clock, CBS 8 reports. Safety of workers is another issue. According to Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez, Amazon's workers are injured at twice the average rate of the general warehousing industry and three times higher than the injury rate for private employers. That's an injury rate worse than for coal miners, trash collectors, lumberjacks, and police officers, Times of San Diego reports. Amazon workers elsewhere in the U.S. have complained that work scheduling pressures have prevented them from complying with COVID-19 public health regulations at times, such as sanitizing equipment and social distancing. Assemblywoman Gonzalez has introduced Assembly Bill 701, which, if passed, would require Cal/OSHA to propose new standards to minimize the risk of illness and injury among warehouse distribution center employees who work under production quotas at companies such as Amazon.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Santee City Council has voted to condemn Nathan Fletcher, the chairman of the County Board of Supervisors, for his comments criticizing backers of the effort to recall Governor Gavin Newsom. In a Zoom call with Democratic Party leaders after the violent Capitol insurrection in Washington, D.C., Fletcher said there is substantial evidence that those leading the recall effort are linked to neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and white-wing militia groups, the San Diego Union-Tribune reports. Fletcher did not criticize those who signed the recall petition. A letter signed by Santee Mayor John Minto and sent to county supervisors slams Fletcher's remarks, adding, "Hate has no place in Santee. Hateful rhetoric has no room in political discussions." Santee's five council members are all Republicans, and Fletcher is a Democrat. But Santee Councilman Ron Hall abstained from voting, stating that he didn't think the letter would accomplish anything and feared it could make enemies. The letter calls for Supervisor Fletcher to publicly apologize and to resign. Instead, Fletcher tweeted the Santee Council's letter with this remark, that moment when the city of Santee officially lost their mind. But Daniel Balcom objects to characterizing recall backers as racists. In a reply to Fletcher's post on Twitter, Balcom wrote, "Sir, people want to recall Governor Newsom because of his failures, from the vaccine distribution to the billions given to prisoners to the rolling blackouts." On Facebook sites devoted to Santee discussions, some praised the council's actions, but many attacked it, noting the city's long history of racial tensions and a council member, Dustin Trotter, who called himself a co-founder of Defend East County, a group kicked off of Facebook after racist and violent posts. Jason Hook asked why the Santee City Council never condemned Defend East County or, quote, "violent behavior in the city of Santee." Some suggested the council's action was politically motivated. One poster wondered why the council asked for Fletcher's resignation but never called for Congressman Duncan Hunter to resign even after he was indicted on federal crimes. Hunter eventually did resign following a guilty plea. During public comments at the Santee City Council meeting, Mary Hyder asked why the council never sent a letter to condemn State Senator Randy Vopel for his statement likening the deadly January 6th Capitol attack to Lexington and Concord. Both Hunter and Vopel are Republicans. Others derisively referred to the city as Clanty. The city has a history of racially motivated incidents, including a shopper recently photographed wearing a Ku Klux Klan hood and two other shoppers in masks with swastikas. There have also been violent altercations between racial justice protesters and counter-protesters in recent months. Some individuals wore Confederate flags as they taunted protesters and even waged physical assaults, as East County Magazine photographers documented in videos last year. The city has taken some steps to address racial issues, including its recent adoption of a campaign promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion. But the reactions provoked by the Santee City Council's letter serves as evidence that the city still has a long way to go to restore the public trust on racial equality issues. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Angela Kurish.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Brianna Gomez with the Crime Beat Report. Sheriff's deputies' pursuit of a stolen vehicle ended in tragedy in Spring Valley when the car ran a red light and collided with two other vehicles, killing a young woman and injuring three others, including a 15-month-old child. Shortly after 10 p.m., deputies from the Rancho San Diego Sheriff Station saw a car driving in the 700 block of Grand Avenue in Spring Valley. The car was being driven with its lights off. A records check of its license plate showed it to be a stolen vehicle. Lieutenant Joel Stranger with the Sheriff's Department stated, deputies turned on their lights and siren to stop the car, but the driver sped off. Minutes later, the stolen car collided with two vehicles at the intersection of Hamishaw Road and Sweetwater Road after driving through a red light at a high rate of speed. The suspected driver of the stolen car ran away from the crash but was arrested by deputies after a short foot chase. A passenger in the stolen car surrendered to deputies. A 21-year-old woman in the first vehicle struck by the stolen car was critically injured, Lieutenant Stranger reports. Deputies rendered life-saving aid until relieved by firefighters. She was taken to the hospital where she died, said Lieutenant Stranger. Two men and the 15-month-old child in the second vehicle struck were taken to local hospitals and are being treated for moderate to serious injuries. All are expected to survive.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're tracking our democracy in historic times. At least 31 Americans have died in this week's winter storms. Around 160,000 people in Oregon had no power Wednesday, as did tens of thousands in Kentucky, West Virginia, and Louisiana. Hardest hit was Texas, where 3.5 million customers lost power. The White House responded with immediate support, said Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
FEMA has supplied generators to Texas and is preparing to move diesel into the state to ensure the continued availability of backup power. We are preparing to quickly process requests from other states for emergency assistance.
President Biden also voiced support for a commission to study reparations for slavery. A House panel is considering a bill to allocate $12 million to develop a proposal for remedies. Texas Democrat Sheila Jackson Lee, the bill's lead sponsor, points to a Harvard study on how Louisiana COVID infection rates would have changed if African Americans got reparation payments.
The Harvard study has reaffirmed the fact that if reparations had been implemented before COVID-19, we might not have had this definitive and deadening and deadly imbalance.
Jackson says reparations would work to lessen the racial wealth gap, which would also improve Black Americans' health. She noted slavery's impact is still felt today, such as in Ferguson, Missouri.
I went there when Michael Brown was brutally killed and racially profiled. It wasn't in 1855. It wasn't even in the 1950s. It was in the 21st century. Mr. Brown was racially profiled.
While there's growing support for reparations, particularly after last summer's racial justice protests, the bill is unlikely to pass. It would need at least 10 Republicans to advance in the Senate. Biden said Tuesday night during a CNN town hall he does not agree with Democrats like Senators Chuck Schumer and Elizabeth Warren, who want to cancel $50,000 of student debt per borrower. Biden prefers canceling up to $10,000. Conservative radio titan Rush Limbaugh, who had more than 15 million listeners, died of lung cancer at the age of 70 Wednesday morning. Here, Limbaugh speaks about the future of the conservative movement.
I want to tell you who conservatives are. We see Americans. We see human beings. We don't see groups. We don't see victims. What we see is potential.
Limbaugh led the growth of conservative talk radio for decades, creating Republican talking points and amplifying conspiracy theories, including Trump's groundless voter fraud claims. Meanwhile, a Kentucky County GOP chair called on Senator Mitch McConnell to resign because of his area's strong Trump support. Don Thrasher said the senator, quote, stirred up a hornet's nest, end quote, with his post-trial condemnation of Trump's actions. Finally, a group of Democratic senators wrote a letter to President Biden, urging him to crack down on campaign spending violations and expand voting rights protections in the next election cycle to counter Republican bills in state legislatures to restrict voting. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
President Joe Biden has issued an executive order to reverse former President Donald Trump's, quote, wait in Mexico policy, an action that endangered the safety of migrants who have been camping in unsanitary conditions and in some cases preyed upon by thieves, traffickers, and other criminals. The Trump-era policy also made it hard for asylum seekers to find lawyers or even to learn when their asylum hearings in the U.S. courts were scheduled. But although around 25,000 asylum seekers with active cases are currently waiting in Mexico, only a trickle of these will be allowed to enter the U.S. starting on February 19th. Associated Press reports that authorities plan to begin with just two border crossings, each processing up to 300 applicants a day, plus a third crossing processing even fewer. Priority will be given to those who have been waiting the longest and those who are most vulnerable, NPR reports. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says that migrants should not be misled to believe that the U.S. now has open borders. She stated, quote, "We don't want people to put themselves in danger at a time where it is not the right time to come because we have not had time to put in place a human and moral system and process," Associated Press reports. Authorities have not announced which border crossing stations will be processing the existing backlog of asylum seekers, so as to discourage immigrants from arriving unscheduled. Homeland Security is setting up an online process for asylum seekers to register and check on court hearings. But some immigrant advocates say the process could still exclude many migrants. Syracuse University's Transactional Research Access Clearinghouse, or TRAC, compiles immigration data. Austin Kocher, a faculty fellow at TRAC, says online registration may not be accessible to asylum seekers who lack computer access and are in most need of protection, Common Dreams reports. The new Biden policy applies only to immigrants seeking asylum, who must demonstrate in court that they face a credible threat of violence if they return to their homelands. It does not apply to other migrants, such as those seeking job opportunities or visits with family members in the U.S. Those asylum seekers in Mexico who are admitted to the U.S. to await their hearings may still be placed in detention centers, such as the one in Otay Mesa that has been used by prior administrations to house some asylum seekers. Others deemed low risk may be released to stay with family members. All asylum seekers admitted to the U.S. will be screened for COVID-19 and given masks under the new Biden policy. In addition to adopting a more human process for those awaiting asylum, MSN reports that the Biden administration has also announced plans to provide economic development aid in an effort to reduce the exodus from Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua by addressing the root causes of migration. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Alexa Oslowski.
Pediatric dentists are pleading with families to redouble their efforts to get the kids to brush and floss regularly, especially during the pandemic. Most dental practices are back open, but the American Dental Association estimates dental care spending in the U.S. dropped 38% last year and could drop another 20% this year. Dr. Richard Gesker, the chief dental officer for United Healthcare, says tooth decay is the most common chronic disease among children, and it's preventable.
Parents should really consider fluoride treatments, which strengthens the tooth enamel and helps protect the teeth from decay. And sealants are plastic-like coatings, which are applied to back teeth like nail polish to prevent decay.
February is Children's Dental Health Month, and Gesker says oral health is closely tied to overall well-being. Experts recommend cleaning babies' teeth with a soft cloth, teaching kids age 2 and older to use a soft bristled brush without swallowing the toothpaste, and teaching them to floss once their back teeth come in. Stephanie Thornton with the nonprofit Children's Partnership says preliminary data from the latest Smile Survey in L.A. County found persistent racial inequities.
About 50% of Latino kindergartners had tooth decay, compared with only 26% of white kindergartners.
The ADA recommends everyone continue to schedule dental checkups, cleanings, and routine care. However, the World Health Organization recommends people avoid non-emergency care if they're living in a place with intense, uncontrolled community spread of COVID-19. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today, I'm speaking with Roger Scholey, retired journalist from the San Diego Union-Tribune and author of 6 books, including 3 San Diego Memories volumes and 3 others on local history. My guest is also president of the Balboa Park Committee of 100 and serves on the boards of the San Diego Architectural Foundation and Friends of San Diego Architecture. That's a lot. Welcome, Roger Scholey. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Nice to be with you, Raina.
Okay, let's begin with your history. I know that you're a third-generation San Diegan. You graduated from UC San Diego in 1970 with a history degree, and you've raised your family here. How did you end up as staff writer for the UT for 44 years, and ultimately your involvement in this series?
I was a reporter for the Triton Times at UCSD and was one of the founders in the 60s. And the university does not have any journalism program. So we had to self-teach ourselves how to be reporters and editors and everything else. So that's where I got my training. Then I was also a campus correspondent for the Evening Tribune for several years. And after graduation, I made my way to the UT as a reporter and started in 1974. And I've always been interested in San Diego history. Obviously, I was a history major, so that was part of my profile. And as you know, San Diego schools do very little in the way of history teaching of the local history. You only learn it in third or fourth grade, and you never hear about it, about California or San Diego again.
Right.
So a lot of this is self-learning by San Diegans. And if you're from here, you have more chance of learning about the past through your families. But for, mm-hmm. I don't know, 80% of San Diego residents, they were not born here. So they don't know innately what the place is about, which explains why we vote the way we do sometimes, mm-hmm. how we forget things that happened 20 years ago because we weren't here. And my favorite expression I hear from people is, when I moved here 5 years ago, Sandy was much better than it is today. And of course, you can vote by that 20 times for people who've moved here from one period or another. So in the newspaper, I took a special interest in covering the history of places and people that I mm-hmm. came across. And then I started writing stories about San Diego history whenever I could. And then myself, because I wasn't taught it either. Well, when I left the newspaper in March of 2018, as I was walking out the door, Jeff Light, the editor of the Union Tribune, pulled me aside and said, I have something for you to do. So he told me about this series of books by Pediment in Washington State. They had partnered with historical societies and local newspapers to do dozens and dozens of pictorial histories of their places and people and everything else. So I said, sure, I'd love to do that. So he came out with the first book in 2018 that took San Diego up to 1940. And then in 2019, I did the one from 1940 to 60. And this one that you're talking about today was 1960 to 1980. And then I have one more volume, I think, for this particular series, 1980 to 2020. And I said, well, why do you go to 40 years period rather than 20? And the Pediment people said, as you get closer to the present, people don't think of that as history. They think of that as me. And I don't
right.
care about me because I lived through all that.
Right.
So I think that's probably one reason why we're going to pull 40 years together and quite a romp from 1980 to now. And I figured that one chapter was going to be about 2020 itself because of the pandemic. So that's the most interesting year in our lifetimes.
So we are living a fascinating history. Before we talk about the book in particular, with your perspective as a longtime journalist and a history expert, what would you say is the biggest difference that you've seen in San Diego over the years, and the biggest difference in journalism as well, if I could ask?
Of course, the biggest difference is it's grown a lot in my lifetime. I was born in 1948, so San Diego was 500,000 people about then. And now it's 1.3 million just in the city, and the county itself is 2 or 3 million. Mm-hmm. And if you bring in Tijuana, another 1.5 million, that's maybe 5 million people in our region, which is much bigger than it was 50, 75 years ago. So that's the biggest change, I think, physically in the area. The second thing is that San Diego has become a lot more diverse in terms of demographics, with a lot more ethnic variety from a wave of immigrants who've come here for the last 50 years, which is very interesting. Mm-hmm. And then as this book told me, as I was trying to find the right pictures with the History Center and the UT helping, was the role of women in San Diego. So we went out of our way to pull out pictures of women doing all sorts of things. Same thing with minority groups, trying to highlight them, giving their due, because history is typically about white male, you know, leaders, and not much about the average person. So this book, these books are about the life of San Diego residents in all manner of speaking. So from arts to work to home life, everything is supposed to be a snapshot, series of snapshots over the last, in this case, 20 years of 1960 to 1980.
So literally the way we look at the world and evaluate it has changed.
Yeah, and then you asked about the role of the media and the newspapers in this period, 1960 to 1980. I would say that in 1960, the news was basically the Union and the Tribune. That was the main source of people's information about San Diego news. And over the following 20 years, the role of TV journalism has grown a lot more significant. They're not as thorough as the newspaper, but obviously, but people get a lot of their news from watching TV. And of course, that's not at all touching on the current period where it's all online and many other sources. But in those days, it was basically news. Most people would take a newspaper. Most families would take San Diego Union and Tribune. And now it's many people don't take the newspaper. They get it online or they read other sources. So that's the big difference. I think the other difference in journalism over my career is that the idea of investigative journalism has become much more important than it used to be. If you go back and read the newspapers of earlier times, there was very little of that sort of thing, and analysis. There were sometimes columnists that got into some background, but the prevalence of investigative journalism was not really very active in San Diego until the 1970s. So starting in that period, when Jerry Warren became the editor in the 70s and was in the 80s, he specialized and urged us to be much more investigative in all realms of the coverage, not just big political scandals, but anything.
That explains a lot. Okay, well, let's talk about the latest book in this series, San Diego Memories 3, A Time of Change, as you mentioned, the 1960s and the 70s. You've told us a little bit about your collaboration with the San Diego History Center and the Union Tribune. Give our listeners more of a look at this volume. What's in it?
Well, there are 7 or 8 chapters, and each one has a certain focus. So let me just give you a sense of what those are. This is typically the categories that their pictorial histories include, but some of them are San Diego centric. For example, we have a military chapter, a maritime chapter that you wouldn't see in other cities. But we also, one thing I suggested we do, which is to lead off the book with activism, basically the political turmoil and craziness of the 60s and 70s. And in the foreword, I talked about that as well, saying the 60s and 70s is very much like what we've gone through in the last 4 or 5 years during the Trump administration, and a great deal of polarization and street, you know, demonstrations and sometimes violence outbursts. You know, it's just been, for those of us who grew up in the 60s, they said, this is just like it was when we were 20 years old. So it's been a rerun of historical trends of back then. There's also other non-political kinds of things in the book: sports, leisure, public service, transportation. I also wanted to do something on the seedy side of life, which is crime, scandals. We've had a number of terrible disasters in this period that people who lived here know all about. And the final chapter is about arts and culture. So we have there are about 300 pictures that are in the book, and we can talk about how we went about doing that, because it was a lot of fun and a lot of work, though.
How did you go about doing that? Tell us.
Well, I started with a timeline, because I'm a historian, so I believe in looking at history through time and chronologically. So Mary Maudie Agudo, the UT archivist, has been keeping a meticulous timeline of San Diego history, starting from the beginning, and she's always updating it with events today and findings from the past that she inserts into her chronology. So I said, well, give me the 1960 to 80 time period. So I went through and I circled all the events and things that seemed to be reminding me of what happened in the news. And then we started looking for pictures along the same lines and tried to categorize all the pictures by these different chapters. And I think we ended up with about 600 or 700 candidates. And then Pediment editors pulled out the ones they thought were the most compelling pictures. And that was about done in April last year. And then I went to work to research all the pictures we picked. I didn't want to do that first because I didn't want to research something that wouldn't show up in the book. So luckily I have access to the UT's digital archives back to the beginning. And so I was able to plug in an event or the date of whatever the picture was and find the story that's tied to the picture.
Wow.
Which is very much different, much more revealing than you realize, because the pictures the History Center has does not have any of that sort of information on the picture. It just says, right, seeing, you know, traffic congestion on Torrey Pines Road. Well, I looked up the picture, the story that went with that is all about the congestion and that the fact the freeway was under construction nearby and that would relieve the traffic congestion. So there's lots of examples of that where the picture doesn't say 1,000 words. You have to look up the words to see the real information.
Well, I would think if you change some of the cars and the clothing, the picture might look similar to, say, a current time, but the explanation, the reason, the context is so different, right? Exactly.
Yeah, the details make the story. So I mean, sometimes these picture books that you get are not very revealing substance-wise. They're just a couple of lines about describing something that you can see just by looking at it. So I wanted to make this really a book about an information-packed book. So I hope people actually read the captions, because they're gonna learn a lot about San Diego history by reading what is the pictures are all about. So
it sounds like
I could have written a book about the San Diego 1960 to 80. Richard Perra wrote a series of books for the UT back then, and he got into great detail. But after writing my other books, I began to realize people like pictures, they don't like to read, which is pathetic. But
that's another story, another interview.
So I wanted to pack in as much information as possible in these captions. And sometimes they went overboard and went to great lengths to check people's names and addresses, names and backgrounds, and even found obituaries of people who died who kind of revealed some information about them that wasn't evident at the time of the story, the picture that was run. And I've just found one mistake somebody sent me, which had to do with the Padres sometimes. So we do make mistakes. I tried my best to avoid them, but we did what we could to check everything out.
It sounds like a fun process overall.
It was.
Now, San Diego is famous for being called America's finest city. Do you have any historical perspective on how that came about? And if any of that is reflected, well, I'm sure it's reflected in the series, but what's the history of that?
Well, the phrase America's finest city has a very particular origin. That was the decision by the Republican National Committee to pull out the 1972 election or convention from San Diego over a series of scandals going on about that convention. So Pete Wilson was the mayor at the time, and his press assistant, Aldo Boss, a former UT reporter, wrote a speech about the what we would do as San Diego to counteract the bad publicity that came of losing this convention. So they declared America's Finest City Week for the same week of the Republican convention. And that phrase stuck, and it became, we had America's Finest City Week for many years, and Finest City Marathon, and lots of other things. But parenthetically, actually, I should admit this, at that year, I was actually working in Washington, D.C. at the Republican National Committee. So I was on the other end of the news where they decided they had to pull the convention out of San Diego and what went into trying to quickly move it to Miami Beach, which is where the Democrats had their convention as well. So I was, you know, a big booster of San Diego, and I was carrying San Diego's torch in the RNC saying, hey, that's terrible, we should stay in San Diego. And of course they didn't, but it was fun watching it from afar.
Isn't that amazing how the slogan stuck? Yeah. In Memories 3, what is your very favorite picture and caption? What makes it your favorite?
Oh, well, my favorite is on the back cover of it, and it's on, it's on page 159, and it shows two kids at Comic-Con in 1976, and they're both sitting there reading a Howard the Duck comic book, what I love about this picture is it tells several stories. First of all, comics. Second, Comic-Con, which is a San Diego creation.
Right.
And these two boys, one black and one white, sitting there as chums reading this comic book. So if you want something symbolic about San Diego's progress in being a diverse city and a fun city and everything else, this picture says it all. So that's my all-time favorite in this book. And when I came across it, I said, this is fantastic. I tried to find these two kids, but I wasn't able to track them down.
Interesting. It sounds iconic.
Yeah.
Now, the architectural boards and the other committees that you're involved in, do they inspire your work? Do you think you'd be getting involved with the same projects without the involvement in all those boards?
It grew out of my job at the UT for mostly my career was growth and development. And so I was very interested in San Diego's growth and its buildings and planning of San Diego and architecture and everything else. So, one feeds the other, you know, and there's a lot of development type pictures I wanted to put in this book because that's my favorite thing is how San Diego grew physically. And so I serve on those two groups and the Committee of 100 in Balboa Park, always being mindful of San Diego's architecture and the need to save pieces of the past, because if you don't have them, you don't think about the past. So there's been this book has some of that in here, some mm-hmm. historic preservation mentions. And so in the 1960s, that's actually when the whole U.S. became much more interested in historic preservation than it had been in the past. And the mm-hmm. federal government passed a law creating the National Register of Historic Places. And San Diego created its historic site board and other groups like Save Our Heritage Organization were formed at the time. In our group, the Committee of 100 at Balboa Park, also in the 1960s, because San Diego was rushing ahead in the 60s and 70s with growth and development and thousands of people moving here and building new subdivisions all over the place. It also had a very valuable elements from the past to save. And the Gaston Quarter, for example, was the association was founded in the 70s to save those buildings on Fifth Avenue downtown. And some buildings were lost, and we show pictures of that. Mm-hmm. But others have been saved or restored or reconstructed. So we still have a lot to look to, but we've lost quite a lot of important buildings, including this year, the stadium's being demolished. You know, I mentioned there's a nice pictures of the stadium being built in 1965 to 67, mm-hmm. but the next volume will show the stadium be demolished. You know, that's, to me, that's one of the great crazy things about San Diego is we build something and 50 years later, we throw it away. Horton Plaza Shopping Center is going right through right now. So this is history in the making. That's what, it's an American thing to throw away the past and don't remember it. That's good and bad in some ways.
Yeah, that leads me to, I guess, the question, why does it matter? Why is it so important for us to look back as well as forward?
Well, there's the usual statement that if you forget the past, you're condemned to repeat it. Well, you never repeat the history. It never happens that way, but there's certain things that come up in one time and then a couple of generations later, we find it up again. I mean, this whole thing of right now we're going through with the Republican Party trying to battle back the QAnon people mm-hmm. Just shows you how dangerous forgetting the past can be. I mean, I was thinking, you know, now we know why Hitler was able to take over Germany with a minority of people, because the vast majority of Germans didn't take him seriously. Well, this is exactly what we're witnessing today with this whole battle of the QAnon people and the fake news people and all that. They just pick their own facts or create them or invent them. And if the public doesn't doesn't educate itself, they're going to be, you know, going to face some totalitarian results in the U.S. Yeah. In the rest of the world, you know, that they were surprised the U.S. came this way. But if you read American history, we've had this sort of thing happen over and over again.
Right.
From the Revolutionary War to the Civil War, all of our mm-hmm. battles have had this sort of conflict between groups, between regions, between mm-hmm. people, between generations. This is nothing new. If you don't read you don't learn the history, you're gonna be make the wrong decisions, I think, and when you go to the ballot box. So I wish that we would have. Well, Texas apparently is a very good state for learning, teaching local history, state history, partly because they were a separate country for some years in the 1830s mm-hmm. and 40s. But California doesn't take any of that seriously. So there was a lot of talk and action at the state level in California in order to make people more aware of diversity and minority groups and their contributions to California. I'm hoping that effort broadens out to the general story of California and San Diego and other localities, because we could use a lot more real knowledge of that personally than we do now.
Yeah, so let's hope history finds its way back into all levels of schooling, yeah. Right? Yeah.
It never was. I mean, actually, it's never been a priority in the sense I'm talking about. So,
okay, good point.
It'd be nice to take that on.
Very good. I've got one last question for you. Tell us just a little bit more about what you're working on now and when we can expect to see it in print.
Okay, well, the plan is this year, which I haven't started yet, to work on the last copy of the last mm-hmm. Entry in the series, San Diego Memories, 1980 to 2020. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take in the same categories as we've had in the past. As I said at the outset, I think one chapter probably will be devoted to the pandemic year, because that is just an amazing thing that happened here and around the country, around the world. So just as we had an activism chapter in the 1960 to 80 book, I think 2020 will be sort of the opening chapter of the story, because even though it's contemporary, it's going to be something everyone remember forever, I think.
Right.
So I'm going to go through with Mary and start with the chronology of the last 40 years and start to pick up pictures. Now, the difference between this book and the last ones was the History Center had a wealth of 2 or 3 million images that we could draw from. They're all been cataloged. You could just go on their website and find pictures, and which I did. They don't have virtually anything from 1980 because their collection is mostly Union Tribune negatives and photos. So those were the four pictures in his book, all the other books, to the extent we had them. The new issue, the news book, was to be totally relying on UT file photos. And I don't have access to them at my home computer yet. I hope I can, because otherwise Mary's going to do all the work finding them. But it's going to make it, it'll be similarly organized by finding the pictures, tracking down the stories that go with the pictures, and then writing the captions to go with them. So I think they'll, if everything goes well, we'll finish this by in time for the holidays this coming year.
I can't wait to see it. I think it will be a fascinating enterprise choosing the cover picture. There's so many choices.
I've been thinking about this. And what is the, what is the one, and in this case, the picture we did in this book was John F. Kennedy at a pre-election rally in San Diego in 1960 during the presidential campaign. We picked that. I said, gee, what happens if Trump gets reelected? This will look kind of strange to have Kennedy on the cover, but it was a time of change. He was a new generation, you know, so that in many ways that was a very good choice for this book. But for the 1980 to 2020, I mean, there's so many possibilities, and it's somewhat inspiring, not a negative thing, but some, because we could have all kinds of pictures on the cover that are kind of scary,
right?
Or we could have something that's in ennobling, you might say,
so inspiring or hopeful at least.
Yeah. So I will just kind of, I mean, you could have someone with a shot in the arm or getting a virus,
right?
Shot, that
right.
A little bit too
right.
Specific, but we'll find something will come out. And in the what happens is Peniman goes through and picks all the pictures and puts them in the layout, and then they come up. They pick several of them as potential cover pictures, and we all weigh in on which ones we think are the best, and then they pick the one because they're in charge.
Well, if you need another vote, let me know.
Okay.
Roger, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. I'm glad to talk to you too, Raina.
To contact Roger Scholey, please write him at rmscholey, that's S-H-O-W-L-E-Y, at yahoo.com.
Oh, we should also mention how people can get the book, because it isn't available in stores. So they can get it online by going to pediment.com. That's the publisher. And you could write me if you want to get a copy that I can autograph. So you can send me a request as well.
Very good. An autographed copy for your coffee table.
Right.
Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. I'd like to talk today about some plants you can plant to bring in hummingbirds. Everybody loves them. Nobody wants to fill those feeders. They get ants in them. They get bees in them. They get mold in them. And someday I'll convince my husband to quit putting sugar water in them and feeding them, because there's enough in my yard to keep every hummingbird in East County quite happy for quite a while. So what do you want to put in your yard that will bring in the hummingbirds? My favorite plant is a cultivar of a native plant. It is called Galvezia firecracker. If you go to most nurseries nowadays, this plant has become so popular that you can get it. Just ask for firecracker, which is different than Russellia. It's a Galvezia, G-A-L-V-E-Z-I-A. This is a plant that gets to be about 4 feet tall, 4 feet wide, and it has red tubular flowers. And that's the key, isn't it? Red tubular flowers. That's what brings in the hummingbirds. They love it. Can't stay away from them. This is a much more manageable and nice plant than the Cape honeysuckle with the big orange flowers and the plant that gets to be 15 feet tall and 20 feet wide and goes everywhere and is a big floppy mess. Try a firecracker and see what you think. You can grow it in the sun, in the shade, in part sun, in part shade.
with a lot of water or with just a little bit of water, and it will be fine. I have a neighbor who grows it under pepper trees, and the gardeners come every week and prune them into little round balls, and they never really get to bloom, and those trees have suffered through that for the last few years without a single one of them dying. Now, that's what I would call an obliging plant. Another good plant that will bring in lots and lots of wildlife to your garden, and hummingbirds especially, is called California fuchsia. It's called Epilobium. Some of you may have known it in the past as Zauschneria. What a great name. So there's a good password for you, Zauschneria. Who's going to use a word like that for their password? Zauschnerias, or Epilobiums, California fuchsia, are a gray plant, and they have a bright orange-red tubular flower. Once again, great for hummingbirds, really keeps them happy. This is a plant that will actually spread slightly on its own and will get by even if something bad happens to the irrigation and nobody irrigates it for 6 weeks or 6 months. It won't die. It'll be fine. Anytime you go to a nursery, look around and look for the plants that have the red tubular flowers. That's the key to hummingbirds. Now, my friend Maureen Austin, who puts on the Sage and Songbirds Festival every year, says there's two kinds of wildlife attracting plants out there. There's ice cream cones, which we're talking about now. These are the tubular shaped flowers that the hummingbirds like. Or there's pizzas, and pizzas are the flat flowers, the daisy-type flowers, that you see butterflies landing on. If you think about butterfly bush, Buddleia, which brings in all sorts of cute little butterflies, it also is fragrant. It's known as summer lilac here, or butterfly bush. Then if you take a close look at those purple spikes that grow on that, that bring in the butterflies, you'll see a whole bunch of little bitty flowers. And that's what the butterflies are landing on. That's what they like. So that's a great one. Probably the best butterfly plant that you can come up with, though, is always going to be the butterfly weed, milkweed, Asclepias curassavica. It has orange and red flowers on it, and it just grows like a weed in your garden. Not invasive, just reseeds very effectively. You will know that you have succeeded when you see interesting-looking green caterpillars all over the plant, eating every leaf. In my garden, I pick them off and I move them to another milkweed after they eat all the leaves off one. I don't try to fight them because they're going to turn into monarch butterflies. So my garden is full of monarch butterflies, which I consider to be flying flowers. So keep in mind, butterfly milkweed is a great plant to add to your garden repertoire.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.